This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II. Hey, Carrie.
How you doing?
So I'm going to say a word to you, Carrie, and I just want to get your immediate reaction.
Okay.
Smuggler. What's that word mean to you?
Smuggler. Okay. I think of like the Monopoly man when he's like stealing money. I don't know if this is the right depiction, but I think of like a cartoon character like taking money and smuggling it, or someone who's smuggling drugs, like conniving, sneaky.
Yeah.
All of those connotations kind of come up when I think of smugglers doing bad things.
Yeah, right. And sometimes in entertaining context, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you think about it, one of the most popular characters in movie history, Han Solo.
Oh, yeah.
He's a smuggler.
Yeah.
But you know, you're right that in general, that word is not attached in a favorable way to anybody. It is a criminal description. And today on the show, we want to talk about that word in a very specific context. Mm-hmm. The immigration crisis that we face in this country, the hundreds of thousands of people mm-hmm. who are heading every day, really, toward the southern border between the United States and Mexico. Wanting to be Americans, smugglers are playing a really important role in that crisis. And a professor who used to be at the University of Michigan is now at UCLA, named Jason De Leon, has written a book about these smugglers, trying to give us a different picture of who they are and what they're up to. His book is called Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling.
These are the folks who are guiding them, right?
These
are folks who are, when migrants are trying to flee their countries, come towards the border, they're guiding them through what we understand to be dangerous territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the ones who know how to navigate it. And I believe at the same time, you know, there are folks, there are security members who are trying to slow them down,
disrupt
the migration.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about what some of these migrants are doing.
Right.
They are traveling the equivalent of the distance between Michigan and Florida, for instance, mm-hmm. on foot often to try to get away from circumstances in a country that they are living in or from mm-hmm. to get to the United States. It's a dangerous trip. It's fraught with physical dangers, geographic dangers, but it's also fraught with dangers from the other people you might encounter along the way. And so what's developed is this system of quote-unquote smuggling people, helping them navigate those physical barriers, but also navigate the dangers that exist from drug trade, from the drug trade, from gangs, all of these other kinds of hazards.
It's really easy from our perspective as Americans, people who already live here, who don't really encounter the type of danger or instability to the same degree that folks who are migrating here encounter, can think of those folks as bad actors,
yes.
as folks who are facilitating this quote-unquote illegal migration to our country.
Yeah.
But I do think because Jason De Leon spent Seven years in Central America working and talking and learning who these smugglers are, what work they do. This book and this conversation will give us really good insight into what's really happening from their perspective.
Yeah. And here's why this is a critical conversation to have at this time in a city like Detroit. Mm-hmm. This is a city that is built on immigration mm-hmm. for not just the last 10 years or 15 years or 50 years, but the last 150 years. There is this steady arrival of people here to be not just Americans, but to be Detroiters. And right now, if you go to Southwest Detroit, which is the place where a lot of the migrants from Central and South America mm-hmm. tend to settle, there's a lot of movement around change in that community because of the number of people who are coming from countries that we haven't seen a lot of people from before, like Venezuela. There's a surge of migrants from Venezuela into Southwest Detroit that's challenging social services and other things. The way we think about what these people are doing and who is involved in their transportation and arrival here is critical to understanding what's going on in our own community. And so this is a really timely book for something that's happening right here in our own backyards.
Hop on into it, Stephen.
Yeah. So I want to start with an idea that I think is kind of at the center of your book, Soldiers and Kings. And I want to start with a passage that's really early in the book. Escobar, who is a low-level smuggler who you write about, he is being arrested by the authorities. And one of the agents says to you, Jason, you shouldn't be hanging out with these Hondurans. Your friends are bad people. And you say back, I don't want any trouble. Will you please let him go? He didn't do anything. So a lot of people, of course, would describe these smugglers as bad people, as bad actors, as part of the problem in the immigration mess that we have created in this country with our policy and with our actions. But it seems to me that your goal here is really to paint them in a much more complicated light, in a much more complex way. Let's start with why we should believe that's true. Why should we believe that these are not bad actors who are part of the problem?
I think that's a great question, and it really gets to the kind of fundamental issue that I think clouds the discussion around these things, because people tend to think about smugglers as these kind of wholly separate actors, right? They're away, that they kind of fall out of the sky and then they just start kind of doing their work. And I think we need to conceptualize smugglers as, for me, they're really a symptom of this much bigger problem of migration, of capitalism. They are responding to changes in border enforcement. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're providing a service for people who really need it. And I think, you know, if people had no need to migrate and there were no barriers to movement or this kind of hyper border enforcement industry, smugglers wouldn't, there'd be no reason for them to even exist. But I think people kind of imagine them, they go, oh, you know, they hear something really terrible has happened to migrants, and usually smugglers are the first ones blamed. And then they tend to think about that as, oh, well, all blame must then fall squarely on those folks, even though, you know, we have to understand, well, why are people needing to hire smugglers in general, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so I think for me, painting them as the bad guys, I think kind of misses the whole point about this much, much more complex issue.
Is it too simple?
I think so. I mean, I think with anything, it's, you know, and, you know, what is a bad guy? I mean, people want these kind of monolithic black and white kind of, descriptions or categories. And I'm like, life
doesn't work that way.
Ever.
So let's start here. One way to define good guys versus bad guys is to say people who follow the law are good guys and people who break the law are bad guys. And again, I'm yep. doing that purposely, right?
Absolutely.
Reducing it down to something very simple. But there are a lot of people, I think, who govern their consciences that way, right? The law is the arbiter of what's good and bad. So why is that insufficient here?
Because I think about the history of this country, how many unjust laws have existed, right? And I mean, it's like we can look back to, women's suffrage, or when, like, you know, when black people were not considered to be wholly human. I mean, there's all
at
these,
all
you know,
human,
I mean,
right?
And, so, you know, and people will come at me with that and say, well, you know, the law is the law. And you'll hear that from a wide range of people, including, you know, Border Patrol agents, many of whom are Latinx, who will say to me, you know, well, my parents might have come undocumented, but that was then and this is now, and the law is the law now, and I've got to, uphold that. And for me, the question has to be then, well, what happens when these laws are unjust? Why are thousands of people dying a year to cross borders? Where are they going? What's driving them? What's driving them to leave their countries? What's pulling them towards these different places? And then how do these issues of legality then fit into those kind of conversations? But people want very simplistic, you know, you break the law, you go to jail. You break the law, you die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you know, as an anthropologist and as a person who I think is concerned about, you know, human rights and social justice, my first question is, well, what is at the root of this law, right? And who is this law helping and not helping? Who is it excluding? Who is disproportionately feeling the brutality of these laws? But, you know, in this country, that's usually same thing with, like, it's easy to kind of fall back on that, or it's also very easy to just in general blame immigrants for every societal ill that exists.
So another frame that some people might try to use for this is morality, right? That a sense of justice or ethics or rule following, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, is the way that we ought to think about this issue and these actors, these smugglers who you have spent a long time getting to know and understand. From that perspective, tell me why we should think differently, I guess, about these smugglers than most people would. That word, even that word, smuggler, that invokes this idea of a rule breaker, of someone acting outside the law. Is that person, in your judgment, also acting outside the circle of morality?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I kind of came to learn during this whole process was that, you know, I had pretty simplistic understandings about what a smuggler was. And, you know, they run, you know, like any individual, you know, or any group of people, they run the full gamut of, you know, mm-hmm. from one end to the other of whatever spectrum you want to put them on. And, you know, I found it interesting in the beginning when I was talking to smugglers who would refer to themselves as guides, say guías, right? Because guide then somehow has this you know, negative connotation.
It's a cleaner word.
Yeah, right? Like I'm guiding you through this thing. And the guides that I work with or the smugglers that I worked with, you know, some of them I would describe as very sort of kind and well-intentioned sort of people. I would describe others as people driven mostly by money or, you know, more likely to rob you in the end. But, you know, and even amongst themselves, they would say, well, there are good smugglers and there are bad smugglers. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody wants to be, you know, everyone is self-described as a good smuggler. But, you know, even within the kind of smuggling system, you see this wide range of what it means to be a good one or a bad one. And even those folks would say things like, you know, because many of the guys I work with are in, you know, transnational gangs or in MS-13. They were 18th Street. I worked with a big group of bloods who were moving back and forth between Honduras and the Bronx. And they would say things like, well, what I do on the street, that I would consider to be, you know, bad or evil. But what I'm doing on the train tracks, in some ways, I'm providing a service. And here, maybe there's some potential also for redemption for these other things that I'm doing elsewhere. And so even they were thinking about these.
So they're kind of aware of
100%.
The moral context here.
100%.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, and really wanted to talk about it, really wanted to like explain themselves and really help me to understand the complexity of their own experiences, which I found to be just, you know, really, for me, kind of life-changing to get up close and personal with these stories.
So then let's pull the lens back a little and talk about the broader context that these smugglers and these migrants and the Border Patrol agents and all of these people are acting in. It is a context that is defined by U.S. policy on immigration, and they're reacting to the consequences, I guess, of those decisions. How do we define right and wrong and good and bad in that context, given all the things that are, you know, I think everybody would admit are wrong, they're not working. How do we decide what's the right thing and what's the wrong thing?
You know, this is usually when people get like frustrated with anthropologists, right? Because it's like, I would say, well, we need to take a step back and look at how all these pieces fit together, right? And so, you know, people say, oh, well, like, let's think about what would comprehensive immigration reform look like? And then I would say, well, let's talk about the drug wars. Let's talk about the destabilization of Central America that the U.S. has been involved with for 100 years. Let's talk about global warming, the disproportionate effects that are being felt in Central America that are being driven by the global north. You know, when you start to put all those things together and you go, oh, well, it's like it's this Voltron of problems that creates this then supposedly the singular issue of immigration, which, you know, I think cannot be reduced to mm-hmm. to a geopolitical boundary. That makes it really hard to disentangle it. And then so you go, okay, well, is it the smuggler's fault, or is it, you know, or is it global warming's fault, or is it the U.S. driving global warming? And, you know, it gets really messy. And I think that that's what frustrates people when you try to have these conversations, because they want a slogan, you know, they want something very short and sweet. They want to know the right answer. And I think anthropology is very good at making people frustrated about this whole thing, because it's a frustrating thing. But, you know, the world is like super complex, and you know, it's like, this is why, like, you know, build a wall, what is that, you know, that's an empty statement, and it totally glosses over all of the different complexities of the problem itself.
In your former book, Land of Open Graves, I mean, you write about the most devastating consequences of all of this, the death that awaits so many people who decide that they've got to get to America and they can't wait. So they'll take any chance, any risk, any path that presents itself to them. I mean, that seems like a very clear wrong side of all of this. And yet there are people who feel like are still confused about it and want to say, well, the wrong there is the actions of the people who end up dead, right? Yeah. For leaving their country, for coming to this country without invitation, that they are in the wrong.
I really thought naively that if people just knew what was really happening and they understood what was at stake and the pain and the loss that people go through to just survive, that if they could understand that, then they would be more empathetic. But that's clearly just not been the case. I mean, some people, and I think that it's not just this lack of this sort of like ignorance of the issue. I think there's also, you know, racism plays a huge role in this thing, and mm-hmm. and the othering of the immigrant, the othering of people, that makes it easy then to have less value attached to those folks' lives. And you know, one of the things that I try to counter with that, and people say, well, if you die in the desert, it's your own fault, it's the smuggler's fault. And I say, well, you know, the Border Patrol by design has people come into the desert. That's supposed to deter people. They thought if enough people died that they would stop coming, but clearly that's not been the case. And so mm-hmm. my response is usually, you have to imagine then how dire must things be for you to walk into the desert with your child, because that's the best option that you possibly have. And but sometimes even then people will just say, you know, law is the law. Mm-hmm. And that's really frustrating for me. And that's like a question of, or an issue of empathy as well. You know, and I always think like, well, as an educator, I don't think I've failed. I think that there's like, maybe your parents didn't teach you enough about empathy, or just trying to understand that people are coming from very difficult circumstances. And we need to imagine that. And especially because we're getting a window into our future.
Yes.
I mean, what's happening right now, I mean, this is what's coming down the pipe, you know, with global warming, with, you know, forced migration, displacement, the things we're seeing at the U.S.-Mexico border and the Darien Gap in Central America and elsewhere, the Mediterranean, this is only going to get worse. And we need to be able to look at this in a more nuanced and, I would hope, empathetic way.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ironies, I think, is our own history and how murky the immigration picture is if you try to look backwards in U.S. history. And look, there's a lot of mythologizing about immigration in this country and these kind of heroic stories about people sacrificing everything to get here, which is a really different way to phrase that, right? I mean, the migrants today are sacrificing everything as well. It's not seen as heroic. And there are lots of reasons for that. But the difficulty in understanding and transferring that imagery from, say, early 20th century America to early 21st century America is everything. It is the reason we can't get past, I think, the the policy hurdles that stand in front of us.
And selective amnesia, you know, it's like, oh, it gets really frustrating when people don't want to, when they mythologize Ellis Island as if that was this wonderful place to show up to. And you're getting robbed, you're getting swindled by agents. You're being, discriminated legally in all kinds of different ways. But you fast forward 100 years and people now have they don't want to say that, and I've tried to make this argument that the Sonoran Desert of Arizona, I mean, that's the new Ellis
Island.
That's
Ellis Island.
But people don't want to believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking with Jason De Leon about his book, Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined. We're talking with Jason De Leon. He is a professor of archaeology at UCLA and the author of a book titled Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. We're talking about this book, what it tells us about people who help migrants get to our country and circumvent all the barriers that we have put up to people coming from especially Central and South America. We're talking about how these people operate, what we should be thinking about what they're doing, how we ought to contextualize what's happening there. And in a little bit, we're going to talk about some of the solutions that we need to be thinking about to make this all easier. So, Jason, I want to talk about the decision that you make here to highlight smugglers, immigration smugglers, and why you make that decision. I think it's fair to say that the book humanizes these characters in a way that I haven't seen before. And there's a risk in that, right? We're talking in the last segment about the way I think we instinctively react towards like smuggler and the idea of a smuggler and all this. So take us back to the beginning. You spent 7 years with these workers, really, these transportation workers of a sort. Why'd you decide to do that?
A couple of things. One, I ended up meeting, I had finished my first book. We went to Mexico for summer for a field program, and it was kind of my last hurrah with migration. I wanted to move on. I was actually thinking about a project here in Detroit with law enforcement. And I went to Mexico, ended up meeting this young smuggler named Roberto, and kind of got to know him, was learning a lot about his backstory and, his attempts to kind of get away from the game. And then he ends up getting murdered, pretty soon after that end of that first field season. And his death really kind of shook me in a lot of ways. I mean, made me question everything that I was doing research-wise, just really kind of sent me into a tailspin kind of emotionally, intellectually. And so I started thinking, I had promised him that I was going to try to tell his story. When he dies, I feel like there's this sort of commitment to then go into this thing that I had no real interest in exploring. And so his death kind of pushed me into the subject. And then when I got into it, I told myself that I had no business writing about smugglers if I could not find something human and relatable about their existence, because it could be, it's easy to demonize these folks from a distance. Mm-hmm. And I think it's much more difficult to get up close and then try to write, I think, a more nuanced and complicated picture, which I knew if I forced myself to go into this, that I would have to do that. And I was hoping also that it would make me think differently, because I could write another book about migrants, and migrants are easy to, to valorize or to have people sort of feel sorry for them. But, that's kind of a story we've heard a lot. And I wanted to talk about migration in a different kind of way. And so the subject of smuggling was just a very challenging one. I mean, it's like both from a research perspective, you spend all this time in this like hyper-violent context, mm-hmm. and then you try to come out of it and write something that you've, that, that feels even, you know, it feels even-handed, that feels kind of true to the people who, you know, shared so much with me. But, you know, I partly did it because I wanted to force myself to work hard. And it fundamentally changed me in a lot of ways, in completely unexpected ways.
So I want to go back to something you just said, this hyper-violent situation or context or environment. What describe, I mean, I know that it's laid out very, very plainly in the book, but describe for our listeners what that violence is about and why it so defines the work.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, 10, 15 years ago, smuggling was still very much a kind of mom and pop thing, mm-hmm. where you would hire someone from your local community and they'd been working there for generations, you know, probably doing the same thing, getting people from Guatemala to Arizona. And, you know, starting around 10 years ago, transnational gangs started to control the train tracks running through Mexico. And then the Mexican drug cartels got very interested in taxing migrants who were coming through. And so that just made the whole thing more violent. Because now you had to negotiate with both of those entities. It got more expensive, and it went from you could no longer just hire some, you know, kind of jovial, you know, smuggler who could kind of, you know, who could grease a few wheels. Now you had to hire, you know, some kid who was in a gang who knew the kind of ropes to get you through this really difficult gauntlet. And so it as smuggling has gotten more violent, the routes and the extortion and the murder and the kidnapping, you have to find now a smuggler who can navigate all those kinds of things. And so mm-hmm. it just creates this very, very hyper-masculine, hyper-violent context where the best smugglers now are the ones who, you know, who they'll tell you that are willing to do the dirty work that's required to get people from point A to point Z.
And the danger that the smugglers themselves face is layered on top of the danger they're navigating the migrants through.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of competition. You know, you've got folks who are in gangs who don't get along. I mean, you've got people who just short fuses, and you're just dealing with various criminal elements. And for me, there was always this undertone of like things were fine until they weren't fine. And that was pervasive everywhere we went everyone is always on edge, because things can just pop off in a minute and it just gets scary so quick. And that being the case, you don't want to have someone with you who's, you know, quote unquote soft. And I think for a lot of the migrants, one of the kickers was you're leaving Central America, you're leaving Honduras because you're being extorted by these gangs and you've had people killed or you know, horrible things happen to you at the hands of these folks. And then you run to Mexico where now suddenly you've got to pay those same folks money to get you through a new set of dangers.
Mm-hmm.
Smugglers now have much shorter lifespans for various reasons. And it's just gotten so much scarier. And I think that's a trend that's just, you know, growing.
So you're an anthropologist by training and that's what you're teaching. Talk about what anthropology tells us about what you discovered and helps us understand its importance in a different way than a political scientist, for instance, might look sure. at it.
You know, I think there was a book review a couple of weeks ago where someone kind of laughed at this quote I had. And it's like, you know, what is anthropology? What is ethnography? And, you know, it's this kind of immersive experience. And there's a phrase that we've used called like deep hanging out, which, you know, that's in the kind of jargon. And, you know, I would say that I have a PhD in, you know, shooting the breeze kind of thing.
In deep hanging out?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm the last person to leave the party. I mean, I'll talk to anybody. But I think one of the things that anthropology gives you is this kind of long-term commitment to understanding a place, to understanding a social process, you know, and it allows you to just see so much more. Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, part of it was, You have to spend enough time in this hyper-violent context to where the violence becomes sort of normalized for the researcher so that then you can write about it in a way that does not feel super fantastic. Because the people who experience it, you know, they're not it's not shocking them because it's part of their daily experience.
They're living it.
Yeah. And so with that, with, you know, with anthropology, it's really, for me, was about trying to get to that point where I felt like I could write about it in a way that wasn't just sort of salacious, but was like me trying to understand what was actually going on and what these, what this violence meant.
And it seems to me that part of the complication, part of the nuance that you get to and that you're trying to highlight here is the distinction in motivation and in, I guess, you know, evaluation between the smugglers and the migrants, right? You started by talking about how we know a lot about migrants and we hear a lot about migrants, and they have a complicated set of motivations and ways that we might evaluate what they're doing. But there is a really different set of those things for these smugglers.
100%. And it's always so surprising to me, you know, they play such a crucial role in this whole process, and yet we know so little about them.
We just think these are coyotes. Yeah. These are bad guys, yeah. Right? Stay away.
And that's not helpful, I don't think, especially for understanding the true complexities of migration. And for me, the smuggler story wasn't so much that I was interested in, you know, in smuggling. It just felt like it was an untold story that through it, I can kind of get you through the door, because people go, oh, smuggling, that's got to be really interesting. And, it's tell me more about that. But then I think about smuggling as a gateway to then thinking about these bigger issues, you know, climate change, capitalism, labor, race. And it's just a new inroad to talk about this stuff, that, cause if, you know, just doing the like migrant perspective, I'm not sure that I could add much more to that at this point, but I did feel like with smugglers that they had stories to be told.
You feel like they connect more directly to some of these global issues.
Definitely. I mean, cause I think about them as, you know, they are service providers and they are a global phenomenon. I mean, it's a $1 billion industry and they are everywhere. And, you know, they've made it pretty clear that, you know, humans have always migrated. The history of our species and our success has been
on movement.
And so as long as we need to be moving, which clearly we will keep having to do as our planet changes, you're going to find folks there helping those people along.
Yeah. I want to ask about a parallel that jumps out to me that I don't think we apply frequently when we think about smugglers or coyotes or whatever we're going to call them in the context of the current migrant crisis. A lot of this reminds me of the Underground Railroad. When you read about the Underground Railroad, when you read about the people who were involved with it, what they were doing, why they were doing it, and what you were just talking about, which is the influence of this more global set of circumstances on the work, right? In the case of the Underground Railroad, it's the coming reconciliation of this horrible institution called slavery, right? That fuels the Underground Railroad in a lot of ways and defines how they pull it together and the ways in which they operate it. That sounds like, I mean, if you substitute the time frame and the particular people who are involved, that's exactly what we're doing now. I'm not sure most people, I mean, you say Underground Railroad, again, people think heroes.
Yeah.
You say smuggler, people think bad guys.
Yeah. And migrants will tell you, you know, this guy might have ripped me off at the end, but he still got me to where
I was supposed to go.
So he's still kind of, I'd still recommend him. You know, he's still kind of a hero. And I think if you took money out of the equation, right? I think that's what gets people, because they go, well, it's being driven.
This is just business.
It's, you know, but I'm like, well, it is and it isn't.
Well, there were members of the Underground Railroad who collected fees and, you know, I mean, it was business too.
Yeah. And so that, but I think people don't, it's the same thing with like the Ellis Island parallel. They don't want to see that. But I think it's important for us to put all of this into context and try to imagine in 100 years, what are we going to think about this
moment?
How
will we think about them? Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Jason De Leon, author of Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. You're listening to Created Equal on WDET in Detroit. We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining us. We're talking with Jason De Leon. He is the author of Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. He is also a professor of archaeology at UCLA. Jason, I want to start this part of the conversation talking about what's sort of driving all of this, and that is U.S. policy, right? There is incredible resistance to the idea of comprehensive immigration reform. There's even resistance to stopgap measures that would relieve some of the pressure points and make this somewhat easier for people. But it does seem to me that at the center of the problem here is the U.S. reliance on the policy of deterrence to try to respond to the migrant crisis that's coming from the South. And just for context for our listeners, this is a policy that says rather than make it easier for people to get here, what we need to do is convince them not to leave in the first place. Stay where you are. Stay at home. We will fix the immigration policy here at some point, but meantime, it's too dangerous to take it on yourself to decide to come here. And famously now, and maybe infamously, Vice President Kamala Harris is sent almost immediately after the election in 2020 to spread that message in countries in Central and South America that you can't just come here and risk it. You can't especially just send your children here and risk it. But I guess my question for you is spending time with the people who are, you know, facilitating the resistance to that policy by helping people do that. What are the pressure points that you would focus on that are manageable, I guess, or would give the most relief? In this case, it's such a mess that I think for some people, it's just overwhelming to think about how U.S. policy could be better and different.
Yeah. I mean, it really, it's a frustrating thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if we really didn't want migrants to come to this country, we could just police the workforce. If we policed the workforce and deported everybody that was undocumented, we know where they are. We know what industries they dominate in. If we were to deport those folks and stop employing them, there would no longer be this huge influx.
People would stop coming.
And then our economy would crash.
Well, I mean, that's the flip side of that, right? I mean, think about where we are. We're in Detroit. Mm-hmm. First of all, the home of immigrants forever, not just people we see coming now. And the whole community is formed by immigration and has been for more than 150 years, really. But if you think about Southwest Detroit in particular, which is where we see a lot of the current migrants settling, you know, it is, I say this all the time, it's the one part of the city that feels like a city where there's thriving businesses and commercial activity up and down commercial corridors, and there's dense housing, residential neighborhoods where it feels like a city. That's what immigration creates. And some of those people are not here legally, right? Yep. If you were going to crack down, a lot of them would leave and those businesses would go away and those neighborhoods would crumble. So no one's talking about that. No.
I mean, I remember I was at a Trump rally in Warren, Michigan in 2016, and people are chanting, build a wall. You know, he comes out there and he says, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to build this wall and I'm going to bring all your automotive jobs back. I'm going to stop Mexico from stealing all your jobs. And people were cheering for that, as if, you know, Mexico was this powerhouse that has all this control over U.S. industries, right? I mean, it's easy to sell people on that narrative, as opposed to saying, you know, the reason that these jobs are gone is because American capitalists can make more money outsourcing them to Brazil or to Mexico. And I think that, you know, this question about, if we were to police the workforce, I mean, for me, we spend billions of dollars on border security that doesn't work. It doesn't slow people down. It kills a lot of people. And then it's like we're telling migrants, if you can get through this gauntlet, if you can survive the desert and the jungles and you can survive crossing all of Mexico and you get here, then we'll ignore you and let you do the jobs that we don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that double standard there, like we hate immigrants at the border and we ignore them and we desperately need them elsewhere. For me, like, you can't have any conversation about immigration reform until you accept the fact that we rely so heavily on immigrant labor. And they're, you know, major contributors to our society in so many different ways. But they're also the easiest scapegoat. And, you know, American political history has been built on scapegoating, immigrants. And so we're going to see it happen this year in this election cycle. And it's just it's a very old and easy to go to trope.
But let's look at the flip side of that argument for a second, though. What if we just said, the border's open. Come if you want. Be a contributing member here, right? We're not going to accept people who are going to break the law, whatever. But we're going to relax greatly the barriers to immigration. People say that we can't sustain that it would crush social services, for instance, and of course it would change the character of lots of different things, right, including our elections.
Sure.
But what's the reason that wouldn't work, or is there a reason that wouldn't work?
You know, the open borders question. You know, I think if you restructured the system to allow people to come and go, to pay taxes, to be monitored like they are, you know, when you come with a tourist visa, I think there are ways that you could build a better system that would allow the kind of, and people to contribute economically, so that it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be this huge burden on the system. But then that would undermine a lot of industries that rely on undocumented labor, because it's highly exploitable. If you don't like what I'm paying you, or you don't like the conditions, we'll get you out of here quickly. There are a lot of folks who are invested in keeping that going. And then there's also, you know, this heavy investment in the deportation industrial complex, the immigrant detention, complex, border security industries. Those are huge, huge money makers. And, there's a certain segment of our society that I think likes the way that things are. And then it's also, you have an easy scapegoat for so many different problems that you can, you know, the kind of the smokescreen. But it's, I mean, you would, I think you could do it. It would just have to be a difficult conversation about a whole bunch of stuff. And it would require some, I mean, we're setting aside
the political limitations here, at least just for the purposes of this conversation, that, you know, you would be, and we have been years trying to unravel the way people feel about this to get to a rational policy about it. I mean, I feel like so much of this is just about people's reaction to the idea of immigrants and the idea of where they come from. I mean, we can't get away from that.
No.
That if these were people coming from Europe, it just would look different.
Yeah, absolutely.
The reaction would look different.
And people, you know, don't want to understand why they're coming and how we as Americans are deeply implicated in that. 15 years ago when I would talk about climate change and migration, people would laugh and say, well, those things, climate change, you know, doesn't exist, or it's not connected to migration. And now, you know, it's impossible to ignore. And so if you're watching like super hurricanes devastate a country like Honduras, and as soon as those floodwaters are seen, people are, you know, they're marching north again, and you're seeing that happen in real time. But I think also from the American perspective, you have to go, well, Honduras isn't this like industrial powerhouse that's driving climate change, right? Mm-hmm. But they are disproportionately feeling it. And so I think part of this conversation has to then recognize how much the U.S. has been to blame for political instability, for the drug wars, for the influx of firearms in places like Central America and Mexico. But as soon as you start bringing those things, people go, well, that's Mexico's problem or that's Honduras's problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a globalist, you know, and you get accused of being something like a globalist. I'm like, we live in a globalized world. And I think that there is no way that we cannot think beyond these borders because, you know, climate change does not know borders, right? And that will be the pressing issue of, you know, the generations to come.
Yeah. So I want to talk about what the smugglers who you got to know and highlight so well in this book, what they want out of all of this. I mean, the migrants, they want to be Americans. And I think at base, we've lost that recognition in some way that what they're trying to get to is the same opportunity that the rest of us enjoy through, you know, whatever means that we got here. And of course, everyone came under different circumstances. So it's clear what they want, I think, and it should be clear to people. But if you're a smuggler operating in this system, what is it that you want? Is there a bigger aspiration? Is there part of what inspires the migrants inside these smugglers too?
You know, a lot of them are failed migrants themselves. So they have no, you know, they've been deported so many times, or they don't have a social network in the states that can support them. And so, you know, they're kind of stuck in limbo. But I think a lot of them in general don't want to be doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They do it because they can make some money. You know, they're uneducated. You know, they've lived brutally difficult lives, you know, lives just characterized by the most intense forms of violence. And smuggling is something that they've been kind of trained to do. But I think all of them would say that they would prefer to be doing something else. Like that nobody wants to be a smuggler. They do it because it's what they're best equipped to do, mm-hmm. but they would rather be doing other things. They want to go straight in some other way, shape, or form. And in the book, there are some folks who do get out.
Yeah.
There are others who they keep trying to get away, but they don't, you know, and they'll tell you, you know, once you learn their backstories and they're just so unbelievable, you know, they'll say things to you like, well, of course I'm a smuggler. Of course I'm like this. What else was I going to be? You know, these are the things.
What
that
choice do I
you
have? Know,
this is who what I've been trained to kind of be in this world. And it's just really, you know, a lot of them will say too, once you're in that environment, once you're in that world, it's really, really difficult to get out.
And talk about the kind of circular nature of all of this, the things that happen to them that put them in a position to have to do this work because they can't do other things. A lot of those things we're responsible for too.
Yeah.
The instability that exists in a lot of these countries has to do with U.S. policy and, of course, U.S. history. We're fueling the things that are not just indirectly through things like global warming, but directly through policy. Some of the things that are making people flee for the border in the first place, but also creating this kind of sub-economy where smuggling is necessary.
Yeah. And we keep them in business. I mean, smugglers, they love Donald Trump because he just raised all the prices, even though nothing really changed. But, right. You know, and they.
Right. He made it more dangerous.
Yeah. And they're just like, this is another way to make money. There's always going to be a demand for their services. And so they kind of see that as they can, like, they're providing a service. And that's how they would often describe it. But also, it's, you know, it's lucrative if you can survive long enough to, you know, doing it.
Yeah. What in your mind is a likely, I guess, end game for all of this? I happen to not think that it's reasonable or comprehensive immigration reform. I think we kind of have lost the momentum for that, and the window for it probably has passed, at least for a generation or so. So what happens? I mean, the migrant numbers are growing and the crises that cause migration are becoming more frequent and more intense. What's the breaking point for all of this and what happens when we reach it?
It's coming. And I don't know what I keep thinking, you know, is there a number that we're going to hit of fatalities or some image that's seared into our brain that's so, you know, graphic and, you know, quote unquote, kind of anti-American. But we keep seeing these things, mm-hmm. you know, the numbers of migrants dying goes up, you know, people disappearing. you know, footage of the Border Patrol on horseback chasing, you know, black migrants with whips. I mean, all these things that you're, that you just think, well, this is it. We're going to see this now and finally go, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think as long as there are people who are willing to exploit migrants for political gain, which is the lowest hanging fruit, I think that this problem is just going to keep, we're just going to keep ramping it up. And, you know, we put babies in cages. We think about all things that have in the last 10 years that we've seen be done. And there's been no kind of big uproar about this. So I don't know. I mean, I think it might just be so many people everywhere that we all suddenly, it no longer becomes a problem that you can export to New York or LA, mm-hmm. you know, that it's just everybody has to deal with it.
Okay, Jason De Leon, it was really, really great to have you here to talk about all of this. And of course, the book is quite wonderful. Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. Thanks so much for being with us on Created Equal.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah.
Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobe. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.